to the Dynamic Duo, now in its last week on GCN Live. I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, sitting in for Jim Fetzer. I will also be on Thursday, sitting in for Jim, and my special guest will be Dr. Judy Wood to discuss 9/11 research. Today, my guest is economist Mark Thornton, who is a PhD economist from Auburn, Alabama, senior resident fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, and book review editor for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. Mark has done a series of recent articles on the monetary and economic crisis, which are excellent, and I wanted to have him on to discuss these pressing matters. Mark, are you there? Okay. We're about to get Mark Thornton on the air. Mark is a graduate of St. Bonaventure in New York State, as well as his economics degree is and PhD is from Auburn, Alabama. And he just loved Auburn, Alabama, I guess, because he's still there at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He had an article today on Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S, Mises.org, called Slash and Burn. And this is the exact opposite, of course, what the government's going to do. It's not slashing its expenditures. It's expanded them immensely, just beyond my expectation or even imagination. And then burn, he wants ultimately the government to sell off a lot of its assets, which do have a market value, and burn the proceeds. So that's among the other things we're going to talk about. Actually, I watch CNBC as one window on the business press and a window on the economy and the global situation. And I detect a little bit of common sense even emerging there on CNBC. I think this auto bailout demand by the big three, or the once big three, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, has really drawn the line in this shifting sand, because people realize, now wait a minute, if this principle of bailout is so really good, where does it end? And you've got the city of Atlanta, Georgia in line, and just about everybody under the sun who can claim U.S. citizenship. Okay. Mark, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, very good. We had some difficulties, but we are on the Dynamic Duo together once again. This is the third time this year, I believe. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Morgan. It's great to be with you.
You've been doing some very nice articles, and I want to take the other side of the argument, which is pretty easy to do since that seems to be the prevailing opinion in the elite. Although I was just saying to our listeners that even some common sense has started to emerge on in the business press, CNBC being a good example, since I watch that more than Bloomberg. And the request, the demand by the big three to have some financial bailout seems to have lit the light bulb in some of these pea brains, and because they're saying if this bailouts are so good, where do you draw the line? But it hasn't penetrated the brains of Ben Stein or Paul Krugman, who I want to cite as people making recommendations at the other end of the spectrum from Dr. Mark Thornton. Ben Stein has an article, I think it was on Money CNN, Reflate the Economy Now. And among other things, he says, future dangers facing us are all on the deflationary side. That means there's virtually, for all practical purposes, no limit to how stimulative fiscal and monetary policy can and should be. Inflation is not a present danger. Well, my third citation, though, to get your reaction is Paul Krugman had a column in the New York Times. It was reprinted, excuse me, in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette this morning. Depression Economics is the alluring title. Well, let's see him talk sense about depressions. And he says, wow, there's just some incredible things, he says, of course. But emblematic would be his statement, it's much better to err on the side of doing too much than on the side of doing too little. My own back-of-the-envelope calculations say that the stimulus package should be huge, on the order of $600 billion. My immediate question was, why not $700 billion? Oh, I guess they already used that. Okay, well, Mark, we're going to, on the other side of the break, we'll get Mark's analysis of these provocative statements from the mainstream. This is Morgan Reynolds with a dynamic duo. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton, economist from the Ludwig von Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama, and you can find Mark's fine work at Mises, M-I-S-E-S.org. Mark, on the, before the break, I was giving you all these easy targets, like Ben Stein, who says, reflate the economy now. Paul Krugman, who says that we should have a stimulus package on the, that should be huge, on the order of $600 billion. What is wrong with these people, Mark?
Well, Morgan, first of all, you have to listen to a lot of CNBC to get some insight, some real insight about the economy. But everybody's calling for a bailout. Everybody wants to be bailed out. Once they open the floodgates of taxpayer money, it's not surprising at all that people would go for the bailout. Now, as for Paul Krugman, he recently got the Nobel Prize in economics, and although it's hard to fathom that because he's not really an economist anymore, he's just a liberal opinion setter, and you know, when we went through, when Japan went through its economic crisis from 1989 to the present, really, they followed Paul Krugman's suggestions to a T. As a matter of fact, they went beyond his suggestions in terms of they brought the interest rate of their central bank down to zero. Okay, so you can't go any farther than that.
No.
They went on the largest public works projects since the Egyptian pyramids, and you know, built buildings, built highways, you know, anything that they could think of, they sunk government money into it, and that did not.
And I understand their public debt. Somebody had in press the other day that it's 180% of their GDP.
That's right. They've outspent
us in terms of what's on the formal books as debt to service.
Yeah, in Japan at one time, when they followed the liberal market-oriented view, they had one of the lowest national debt-to-GDP ratios. And after they went through this period of the 1990s, to this day, they're still trying to work themselves out of this rut that they've gotten themselves into. And now, you know, their national debt is very high relative to their GDP. And they're almost like in a third world status in terms of how much borrowing they've had to do to try to stimulate their economy, so-called stimulate their economy. And, of course, they've ruined their environment. They've ruined their business climate. And, you know, so Japan has essentially killed itself following Paul Krugman's advice. And, you know, even Krugman admitted this in the year 2002, I believe it was, in the New York Times. He laid all this out, you know, all of this Krugmaniac Keynesianism, and he said, and it just didn't work. We've got to do even more. Well, of course, I mean, there's only so far you can go, and eventually you should realize when you're wrong.
Isn't that the definition of insanity?
Yes, exactly.
You keep doing the same thing and expect a different outcome.
That's right, and that's Paul Krugman for you. Ben Stein is used to be a little bit smarter than that. He's very stingy with his own money, but apparently he's willing to splurge like crazy with taxpayer money. And you know, one gets the opinion that one gets the impression that you know, Ben Stein started out as a pretty good economist and a pretty good entertainer, and it looks like he's going in the direction of his father, who was extremely boring person and a terrible economist and somebody who really screwed up the Fed.
Yeah, another American Enterprise Institute economist.
Yes, and he's actually the one that almost kept Murray Rothbard from getting his PhD at Columbia. So that whole family now has to be written off basically as basically not just no good, but just bad economics. And,
yeah. One thing I noticed about Ben Stein that is sort of in his favor is that he admitted in a column that he's lost a ton of money by following his own advice and being shocked at this downturn and ongoing market crash.
Yeah, just like old Irving Fisher in the 1920s telling everybody to invest, you know, this is going to be perpetual prosperity, a la Ben Stein and Larry Kudlow and all these other cheerleaders for the marketplace, cheerleaders for the stock market. And, of course, Fisher not only was a terrible predictor of the future, but he lost his own personal fortune. He lost his wife's family personal fortune, and he nearly bankrupt the Columbia or Yale University trust fund. And, you know, so some of these people get their comeuppance. And, you know, I can't really feel too sorry for that. The people who have been prudent all along, who haven't taken outrageous mortgages, who save money and who work hard and save part of their money for the future, there's no reason in the world that those type of people should be taxed and harmed economically in order to pay for these people who have made outlandish claims and have, you know, bought up tons of real estate, multiple homes with outrageous mortgages, you know, to bail those people out. That just doesn't make any moral, ethical, or economic sense.
You know, our brethren in the economics profession, let me back up and say, I can't always distinguish whether it's really ignorance and stupidity on the one hand or some kind of deliberate, hidden plot to ruin the nation and cause hyperinflation ultimately and replace it with the alleged Amero. And I don't know what's really going on, which one to blame, but I would say that our colleagues in the economics profession bear a heavy burden here by ignoring and trying to suppress or scoff at the Austrian school theory of the business cycle, which is the only sensible one. It's the only one that explains the data, the behavior that we see regularly. And then we've got, I mean, Kruger, of course, is the poster boy for this. And you look at the economics journals, the prestigious ones. It's mostly equations and hieroglyphics and theorems and lemmas, et cetera. And it's all about, you know, impressing your colleagues with allegedly original, you know, clever mathematical things. I mean, it's just a disgrace, and it's a wreck.
Yeah, they have nothing. They have nothing, Morgan. They have absolutely nothing. They don't know any more. Well, they know probably less than the truck driver and the housekeeper and people who are actually in the real world.
This is the Dynamic Duo, your guest host, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be back with our guest, Mark Thornton, after the break. My special guest today is Dr. Mark Thornton, economist, PhD economist, and senior resident fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And, Mark, we were bemoaning our colleagues in the economics profession who, to me, I guess, are you know, just sophisticated ignorance. They it's not a plot, so to speak, to go awry, although the methods they're so fond of, I think, mislead and fail to understand the economy. But in brief, what caused this crisis? Why do we have these crises in what is supposed to be, or some people call a capitalist system, these regular wave-like booms and busts?
Well, we have the government in charge of the core of the economy, which is money and the interest rate market. I mean, the government, the Federal Reserve, our central bank, is in charge of and has the power over manipulating the money supply. They raise it, they lower it, they're generally increasing or inflating the money supply over time. And, of course, they're manipulating interest rates at the same time as well. And so they raised, you know, we had the tech stock bubble, so they raised rates, and they caused all that crash. And then after the crash in 9/11, they reduced interest rates down very quickly down to 1%, which is essentially zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the housing market was already overstimulated in the economy through tax breaks, low interest, subsidized loans, regulatory issues. And so at that point, instead of going into a recession like the rest of the economy, housing continued upward, more construction, higher prices, boom cities all over the country, and they left the interest rate down at very low levels for a very long time, and they made available overabundance of very cheap credit that everybody thought was, you know, going to stay around and the Fed would bail us out if we got into trouble. And so the housing market, it ballooned into a bubble from 2001 to 2005, basically, in terms of the home builder stocks, and then it lasted to 2006 in the housing market itself. And then, of course, you've got the Fed increasing rates because they're causing prices of gasoline and milk and everything else to rise. And so they started raising rates again, and, of course, inevitably, the housing market went into a downturn. The bubble was over, and those problems started spreading into related industries, mortgage financing, home construction, furniture, you know, all those related industries, banking. And then as those industries are infected from the housing bubble, then you have secondary losers in the economy like basic retail, automobiles, tech, and so on. And so it all emanates from the Fed and their policies of overstimulating or inflating at certain points and then, you know, creating a lot of bad investment in the economy that has to come unwound.
Yeah,
at
that's
some
what's
point.
Really sad is they manipulate. We have artificially low interest rates during the boom, artificial credit expansion, and this misleads entrepreneurs into making wrong investments that otherwise wouldn't occur under natural interest rates, and they undertake these projects that are doomed to fail because they are not in line with the structure of consumer wants, and then it all comes crashing down. And sometimes with the help of like Ben Bernanke and the Fed says, hey, this is getting out of control, we're going to have to pull back on the throttle a little bit. And then, boom, there's all these consequences. Malinvestments are being revealed. And really, somebody pointed out, it's not that Wall Street is dragging down Main Street. It's the reverse, the real economy, Main Street, in effect, suffered these mistaken investments and squandered massive amounts of saving that can only partially be recovered by, you know, it'll cover the variable cost of revenues. But it's tragic.
It really is tragic. And, you know, the Fed sets up these boom periods, and everybody thinks they're a genius. And so everybody gets, you know, very proud of themselves, and they go out and take more risk than even they themselves would have normally done. And so they create that speculative fever when everybody is making money and everybody thinks they're a genius. And now we get to this point in the economy and everybody's losing. You know, everybody's losing money and nobody's a genius anymore, basically, in the economy at this point. So, and that's
a manic,
you know,
depressive, even in terms of emotional outlook.
That's right.
Well, downturn happens, though, here's nobody seems to be discussing this. But my notion is, well, how bad is it going to be? I mean, some of us really think this is the big one, based on two things. One, the first is the size and breadth of these distortions or malinvestments during this previous credit expansion. And you can argue this has been the most irresponsible credit expansion in history. And then the second thing is the nature of the government responses, these interventions that are seemingly going to stimulate or cover up, but they are destructive or counterproductive. as you pointed out in an article, if government had done nothing or made a few of the moves to back itself out of this thing, we might have been through this recession, mini depression already. So what's your, is this going to be really, really bad?
Yes, it is going to be really bad. And I do think that we would have been out of this mess by this summer and on our way back up. You know, because as the crisis unveiled itself a long time ago, I mean, we're talking 2005, 2006, 2007, people were making adjustments all along. The home builders were cutting back on the number of new homes, the number of new lots that they prepared. Mortgage brokers, those people all went out of business and got a different job. Companies started curtailing investment programs. They started trying to find merger partners, and they tried to start selling off lines of products and divisions. They tried to get new capital in from foreign sources and from domestic sources.
Yeah, they're cleaning up the spilled milk.
That's right.
In brief, yeah.
That's right. But it's a matter of survival for the companies. Or the other thing that was taking place is bankruptcy, where companies can't find enough tools to reestablish their credit worthiness, and so they go into bankruptcy. And you know, bankruptcy is a very effective tool for cleaning up this mess, because the company goes into bankruptcy. In some cases, all the assets are sold off, auctioned off. But in a lot of cases, the company goes in and gets a chance to renegotiate its debts, and it can make renegotiation with its labor force and with its lenders and its contractors. So all of that can be reestablished. Of course, the shareholders lose everything. The bondholders take over, and the company emerges from bankruptcy just like it always has, and people continue to get the services. You know, Delta went bankrupt. People still flew Delta. Enron went bankrupt. Enron customers didn't go without natural gas and electricity and cable services.
And,
so
and
it all works.
This is a well-established legal framework for handling the bad investments, either to keep the firm running with temporary protection from creditors or disperse the assets. This is Morgan Reynolds, your guest host on the Dynamic Duo. My guest is economist Mark Thornton. We'll talk more about the economic crisis on the other side of the break. Today, I have as my special guest Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama, and we are diagnosing the situation here with the economic crisis. And, Mark, let me get your reaction to this, and that is we on the of the Austrian school say that, well, at the best you could hope for is in our current political climate that the government would do nothing. If so, markets would readjust. One thing you want is markets in various goods and services clear, and that includes the labor market. We have bankruptcy law. This is a sound method to get resources in better hands. You would thereby rather quickly, compared to some of these strung-out recessions and depressions, reestablish the foundations for sound economic growth. But no. I mean, government keeps butting in and trying to thwart or suppress these very mechanisms that can lead us out of a bad situation.
That's right. You know, when we were on the gold standard and there was no central bank, we had business cycles, but they were called panics, and you know, usually they were all over with and done with within about a year's time. And, you know, so the market can clean these issues up very quickly, very effectively, re-release these resources back in the economy so that they can find new uses, new jobs, new owners, and we can get on with the business of building the capital stock of the United States and increasing the standard of living. But what they've done, as you alluded to in the previous segment, is that they've squandered. They've led us to squander a lot of our capital stock in this country, a lot of it into too much housing, into too expensive housing, and now they're compounding the problem by throwing away more of our capital stock into these bailout packages. And when you misuse your capital and when you essentially throw it down the drain, which is what Washington, D.C. right now is doing, you're losing your capital stock. And, you know, we're not aware of this, but our standard of living is dependent upon this capital stock. The tools that we use, the businesses that we work in, and everything from schools and roads and so forth, that's all the capital stock that our standard of living depends on. You know, this is the great lesson from Adam Smith, that it's the invisible hand that makes sure that our wealth is taken care of and we get wealthier over time. And but that lesson has been
completely
lost. Yeah,
I recall Murray Rothbard was praising the 1880s as being that decade in which the real wages rose the fastest in history. And he points to three things. One is the growing capital stock. The second was rapid technological change. And the third one was a non-inflationary environment that doesn't rob us.
That's right. I mean, the inflation not only distorts decisions in the economy, but it's a way of taking away capital from those who are producing it and earning it and giving it to others, the banks on Wall Street and that sort of thing, or into government spending. And you alluded to the problem that Ben Stein raised of deflation. But deflation is not a problem for Americans. Deflation is a problem of Wall Street and Washington. And that's
right.
Who's afraid of it. That's who's afraid of it. If people were afraid of deflation, they'd be running out of Walmart, you know, left and right. But no, people are attracted to deflation. If somebody says, I'm deflating my prices, then everybody goes to him. I was drove by Big Lots the other day, and people were, you know, more people were there than I've ever seen, you know, and they're cutting prices, they're selling things cheaper, and people are flocking to them. So normal American people love deflation. They benefit from it. It means that their wages allow them to buy more and more goods over time. And during the 1880s, we were on the gold standard. The population was increasing. Manufacturing was increasing. Agriculture was increasing. And prices in the economy were coming down. Everything from commodities into the goods in the store, everything was coming down. So your wage rate meant that you could buy more and more goods every paycheck, you know, and so the American standard of living was rising rapidly during the 1880s, despite the fact that we had, you know, a tremendous amount of immigration into the country. There was plenty of jobs, and
you know,
so those are exactly the right panics.
We used to be the expression, and that brings to mind some history, though. Of course, we had the 1907 panic, still called that. And then in 1913, the powers that be managed to get the Federal Reserve created, the monster that it is, and they actually used the term elastic supply of money and credit. But then when this next recession came, the post-World War I or Great War, so-called, event, the business downturn, there the atmosphere, that one I think officially lasted something like 7 months or at any rate under a year, and it was over almost before it began. In other words, the recovery was followed on quickly. And Herbert Hoover, the then Department of Commerce Secretary, couldn't convince Warren Harding to do anything about it. It was over so fast. But, of course, Hoover was the president in 1929, so he was able to do a lot, kind of a mini New Deal, various interventions that created an ordinary downturn into the Great Depression, and followed on by FDR. And we never did get out of the Great Depression. And that's what one of the things that I fear is that these interventions are so massive and counterproductive that we could experience not only a deep recession or depression, but also L-shaped with little or no recovery.
Well, that's exactly where we're heading, Morgan. There's no question that these bailouts will keep the economy sunk in low gear or below you know, with negative growth for as long as these bailouts continue. And, you know, the panic of 1907 and the depression of 1921, we didn't even find out about that in Alabama until they were both over, you know. So, you know.
Well, you were always in depression then in Alabama.
Well, you know, it's because it affects the two main places it affects is Wall Street and it affects Washington, D.C. It doesn't, you know, those type of old-style panics and depressions were over with very quickly, and the nation gets back on its feet. And, of course, people had enough savings back then that those temporary downturns are met with people saving and adjusting in the market economy to those circumstances. And then you're correct, Hoover was a tremendous interventionist in the economy. He's, a lot of people say, well, he's a do-nothing president. Well, those are people who've never actually looked at what Hoover did as president, because he did everything that was in his power to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think he believed in the Constitution, so he wasn't willing to go beyond what he thought he had the power to do, but anything that he did have the power to do, he did it. FDR, the only difference between the two is FDR did not care about the Constitution. He just went full steam ahead with his programs and his New Deals. And he actually campaigned on a program to reverse all of Hoover's interventionism. And then
yeah, the 1932 platform of the Democrats was very and laissez-faire.
Yeah, it was great. Jeffersonian Democrats almost, and they just lied, and as soon as they got in power, they went on with their series of bailouts that today we call the New Deal.
This is Morgan Reynolds, your guest host on The Dynamic Duo, and we will return with economist Mark Thornton discussing the economic crisis on the other side of the break. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama. And Mark's a wonderful guest and extremely knowledgeable about our travails in the money and banking system and bailout. And Mark, we've got quite a bit more to cover. I do want to talk to you about your recommendations about what we don't want and what we want, and we'll get there. But you mentioned the word bailouts, and I thought economist from down under, Frank Shostak, he had a very good statement about that would make sense to many people, and that is, suppose you had a business with four product lines that were losers and six that were profitable, and let's suppose you'd done everything you could to screw down costs here on the losing line especially, and done all you could to make the products attractive, and yet they're losers. What do you do? I mean, those losers threaten the survival of the whole business. And isn't that what we've got here? You need to free up those resources and have them seek management by better hands, by more enlightened entrepreneurs with new ideas.
Absolutely. You know, and it sometimes that might mean releasing those resources to go work in an entirely different area. So like right now, what we have is a bailout of General Motors, and they could go into bankruptcy and come out of that with fewer car lines, fewer factories, but being able to be profitable. And, you know, the bailout is going to just continue this on. And what they're really telling us, Morgan, is that GM can't survive a bankruptcy, and that it would essentially be eliminated, and it would be the assets would be auctioned off, and the company would be no more. They're saying that it's so unprofitable that
mm-hmm.
why should taxpayers be throwing good money after bad? All what they're saying is that there's nothing worth saving at General Motors, and if that's the case, why are we trying to bail them out? You know, it's not only not going to solve the problem in Detroit, but it's actually going to end up hurting places like Alabama and other states around the South who have automobile manufacturers who are not going to the U.S. Treasury and the taxpayer for a bailout, but they're doing okay. They have low cost, and they're producing cars, but they're going through a difficult period, too. And, you know, by keeping General Motors afloat, that puts additional pressure, market pressure, on car companies in Alabama. So it's actually, you know, it's not going to solve Detroit's problem, and it's actually going to end up hurting states like Alabama and all around the country who have automobile manufacturers who are still profitable.
I was glad to see Senator Shelby, who represents Alabama, doesn't he, in the U.S. Senate?
That's correct.
Pardon?
That is correct. He represents Alabama.
And raised this whole issue, and he's thrown a monkey wrench or slowed down this bailout of the big three. But and it is a regional issue. You've got the Japanese and Germans with transplants and overwhelmingly non-union workers. I think back to an article I did, Mark, in 1986 about how Saturn was basically, it couldn't be profitable with their scheme. It wasn't going to be competitive with a Honda Accord, and that's all proven true, but it was really the stealth reason to have that plant in Tennessee was to form a base from which the UAW could hopefully unionize most of these invaders from overseas who had a non-union workforces, and that's very much failed. You know, the deal used to be that the big three automakers, all right, we'll be unionized. We're not going to try and break strikes or bust the union. We got to live with it. But you do your job, UAW, and you keep all the big three, all the survivors unionized, so we are on a level playing field. I mean, it's a high-wage, belligerent workforce and all the troubles that go with this powerful union. And then you do the same for the supply chain. Well, that all broke down, and it's just a matter of time before these unionized companies are not viable.
That's right. And, you know, the special privileges granted to unions in certain states is the problem for the big three. You know, that's one of their problems amongst many. And that's why, you know, manufacturing has moved away from union workers and into free market workers who are actually getting a you know, they're not being mistreated or exploited or anything.
No,
like
those
that.
Are desirable jobs for a lot of people.
That's right. And I do want to point out that, because I never get a chance to compliment Senator Shelby, but he was against the Chrysler bailout long ago, before Alabama had any automobile manufacturing whatsoever. So this is not
good for him.
A senator just protecting his local economy, because he took a principled and difficult stand, I think, in 1981 against that Chrysler bailout, and as a junior representative at the time, spoke out publicly against it. And so this is one area where Senator Shelby has been consistent and correct.
Mm-hmm.
I don't often get a chance to say that about him, so I want to make that perfectly clear.
And he's been a leader in slowing this whole freight train down. Well, you know, we talked earlier about Ben Stein and Paul Krugman. Let me give you another brand of interventionists who are leading us to the poorhouse, and that is the editors of Barron's, which I get every week, have their cover story is, Mr. President, here's our best advice. And the first three things are moderate versions of the same old thing. Actually, a majority of these eight recommendations. Their first recommendation to President-elect Obama, support an immediate $100 billion stimulus package. Be prepared to launch another one in early 2009 if needed. I mean, these guys are the supposed, you know, friend of capitalism and the investment class. Number two, invest $25 billion each in GM and Ford, each, but demand concessions from labor management and shareholders. Let Chrysler go under or merge with GM or a foreign company. And their third is help owners, homeowners, by using TARP funds to reduce mortgage principal. And not till we get to item four, move ahead immediately with your tax cuts for the middle class. Or is there anything we could endorse? They also endorse free trade. But then they go, their number six is restrict the role of speculators in the market for credit default swaps and increase disclosure requirements for short sellers. More red tape. I don't know how do they identify who are speculators. And every investment is speculative in part. Isn't that, I mean, it's very discouraging to see these Wall Street editors going on about in the same kind of statist regimen that is so destructive.
Well, it's very disappointing. I had not read that piece in Barron's, but Barron's has some of the best writers on Wall Street. Our friend Gene Epstein, for example, is great on a number of issues, and Dolan is good, and I'm not sure who is responsible for that. I hope that
they just say the editors. I don't think it was signed, but I'm just looking at the cover.
I hope there was a lot of debate on that, because those are awful suggestions.
And, they are, by and large. I mean, they're for free trade. Well, thank heaven. How about free trade domestically? This is your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, and my special guest today is Mark Thornton, a terrific economist. We will be back with more on the crisis after this break. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama. Mark is a superb money economist, among other claims to fame. And Mark, I want to raise another issue here where back in 1913, when the bad guys created the Federal Reserve, they actually spoke about an elastic supply of money and credit. And one of the things wrong with that is it works two ways. You can certainly expand it, but then when the bust comes, there's a contraction. And I would claim we need a rigid or inelastic, relatively inelastic supply of money and credit. And one of the scary things that's going on here with this whole elasticity thing is that apparently the monetary base, if you look at the Federal Reserve of St. Louis numbers, the monetary base is increasing at an 800% annual growth rate, where the monetary base would be defined as currency in the hands of the general public plus the reserves in the commercial banks. And this just raises this whole issue. I mean, how are they going to pay for all this stuff, these trillions? And the ugly word hyperinflation is a kind of a reasonable fear. How are they going to pull all this off? It just looks like we're on the road to monetary ruin. And Ludwig von Mises writes that when people get this general idea, they get the idea that they're going to have this, they're not going to let up, that the throttle is just going to be wide open, that can quickly lead to not only this hyperinflation of prices, but abandonment of the dang, in our case, the dollar, the greenback. So what's your assessment of that risk?
Well, Morgan, I wanted to let the listeners know that they can go to our web page and read all about all of this in great detail, including all the books of von Mises. It's all available for free all the time at mises.org. And when you
a fantastic resource. Thank you all for this.
It's a great resource for me as well. I mean, I use it every day because it's such a great tool. And, you know, there you'll find in the Austrian literature this the lesson of the ages is basically if you go to a crooked money system, such as we have right now where you have paper money and you have fractional reserve banking, these systems always end up in a crisis, and they always break down, and they always end up in a hyperinflation unless we somehow adopt and reform, and we go back to a gold standard and a banking system that is not propped up by government, and where banks are required or forced or competed so that they hold all of our demand deposits in the bank. And when you have a system like that, the money supply is perfectly stable. You don't get price inflation. You don't get business cycles. And banking is safe. And, you know, you don't get all these problems. But when you put paper money, you take away the gold, and you allow banks to essentially hold no reserves. If they need reserves, they go to the Federal Reserves and borrow some. This can become a highly unstable type of system. And basically, you make the point that Mises make is that they will continue to exploit this advantage on the American people. And once the American people realize that they're not going to let up, that they're going to continue to inflate, that they're going to continue to lower the value of the dollar over time, then people will stop holding dollars. And when people no longer want to hold dollars and hold dollar-denominated assets, then the game is up. And the Fed is in a position where they're going to, any more inflation is going to result in hyperinflation. And this has been happening on a regular basis through time. It happened in Bolivia. It happened in Yugoslavia. It's right now it's happening in Zimbabwe. There's nothing to do with Argentina.
Even Iceland, it's not a hyperinflation, but all of a sudden Iceland just crashed.
Completely. Completely. Yeah. They had an unbelievable
reasonable money, the pricing system breaks down. It's very discoordinative. It's very the fear factor is enormous. You can have people, you know, ending up starving in the streets that supposedly the state is going to prevent, but it actually ends up causing it.
That's right, and it's not just third world countries that it happens to. This happened in America during the American Revolution. It happened in the Confederacy during the Civil War. It happened in Germany in the 1920s. It happened in France in the 18th century. The world's economic power broke down into a hyperinflation. So this is not an isolated third world type of thing that you never have to worry about. This is a very real possibility, and we're getting to the close to that end game where you get a situation where the economy's in trouble. The government is increasing its spending. It's bailing out companies. It's bailing out institutions. It's taking on debt, you know, to the tune of several trillion dollars. We're up about $5 trillion right now. And what's happened to the Fed is they've completely undermined their balance sheet. They used to hold nothing but U.S. treasuries. Well, those are all gone, and now they're holding, you know, junk bonds and shares of the Treasury's holding shares of companies that are essentially bankrupt, you know, and so the balance sheet of our government.
What we're obligated for, we the taxpayers. Now, you just look at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac; they hold about between them like $5 trillion. Well, it would be very easy to believe that 20% of that is underwater, and that means, hey, you're going to have to pick up $1 trillion just between those two organizations. It's probably more, but I'm just saying it's just staggering what is going on.
Yeah, I mean the problems are tremendous, and they've really, when you bring these problems into the government, they're magnified because there's no entrepreneurs trying to find the best way out of it. And so Fannie and Freddie, you know, they hold mortgages, they back mortgages, they guarantee mortgages. They're not the only one in the government that does that. And so we're really on the hook. And we're also facing the $60 trillion of future unfunded liabilities. Nobody's doing anything about that.
Yeah, this is Morgan Reynolds, your guest host today on the Dynamic Duo, and we're speaking with economist Mark Norton about the economic crisis. And on the other side of the break, we're going to discuss what a sound money system would look like and what reforms we need to make. And today I'm speaking with my special guest, Dr. Mark Thornton, economist, senior resident fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And you can, this treasure, immense treasure of economics and related topics are covered so well there at Mises, Mises.org. And, Mark, I want to shift to this, what should be done. We certainly indicted the and convicted our current system, and everybody's aware that it's fragile and somehow on the verge of bust, and we need a sound money and banking system, one that is depoliticized. And this reminds me of this show meeting that they had with the G20 nations that are somehow dedicated to also firming up the money and banking, the financial system. And of course, they don't have a clue. And you have addressed this. We want to talk about deep reform, but you do it so clearly and compactly. And really, I refer back to a hero of mine, W.H. Hutt, who always insisted that our obligation as economists is to lay out the best and not confine ourselves to what is politically possible, seemingly, at that time. We just lay out the best. And there were three things high on your list. One was to get rid of the Fed in some orderly way. You put it in receivership, but you need to get rid of the Federal Reserve and get its gold holdings distributed right, etc. A second element was the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, needs to go away. And a third thing that has to conform to traditional legal principles would be have the banks have 100% reserves. In other words, if you have a deposit there, so-called, then they have to keep it on deposit, and you just pay for the safekeeping, the guardianship, and then ordering them to transfer funds to whoever the recipient you want to receive it. So there's three big issues there. Some of these are technical, but they're pretty easy to understand. We need to reform the system by getting rid of some of these government institutions that have created such a disaster in our current situation.
Absolutely. You know, and I could create a long list, but the three that you mentioned, we need to get back on the gold standard. That's natural money that people would be buying and selling with silver and gold coins. In order to do that, we just relieve the government of its huge gold hoard, most of which it stole from Americans in the 1930s under FDR, and repatriate the dollars. In other words, take the paper dollars out of circulation and put the gold back into circulation, allow people to mint gold coins and silver coins without any penalties or capital gains taxes or anything like that. So we want to privatize that gold hoard of the government and privatize the monetary system so that we're once again using gold and silver coins that don't change really in value, their dependable value over long periods of time. And so we want that gold standard. And then we want to get the
bank. Now, silver is kind of I was very interested you mentioned silver because I'm inordinately fond of it. But, you know, it's a whole lot cheaper than gold, and it's good for smaller transactions. But you can't have the government fix the values of gold and silver relative to each other. But as I understand it, you're an expert on this. I think Murray Rothbard and maybe others have pointed out that when we did have silver in circulation, it was kind of a sop to the Western miners, and it was more or less like a fancy paper that you printed on. It was really a real secondary tag-along. We were really on the gold standard. Is that correct?
That's correct. We were on the gold standard. If we go back in history, what we find is that silver is the real, genuine money of people. And it's always been, you know, predominantly silver. It started out with copper and then progressed to silver for hundreds and hundreds of years. And gold was used for making large payments and for international payments, for balancing the balance of payments between countries. You would send gold rather than silver because it makes
bullion,
up so much.
Yeah, bullion, big bars, huh? Rather than coins.
Exactly. And so, you know, ultimately I think it's been human nature to go in the direction of silver coins because they contain a lot of value, but they can be broken down into denominations so that people can make exchanges. What happened to get us on the gold standard is that Britain mistakenly valued gold versus silver in such a way to completely drive silver out of circulation. And so everybody was on a gold standard. You know, gold was the only thing that they could use. Well, gold is too large of a value to make day-to-day exchanges.
Yes, and that's certainly where we are now. Much less, doing these FRNs, the Federal Reserve Notes conversions, could really drive up the price of gold to huge levels. But
And it will.
Even though right, gold's what 25% off its peak, recent peak. In terms of it hit what $1,050 at an ounce at the peak in terms of the greenback, right?
That's correct. And yeah. People ask
now,
me,
it's still keeping its head above $700, but that's one of the interesting things that's going. Well, I don't want to go there. Let's talk now. Let's go to the Federal Reserve. Yeah, we somehow, it's kind of a technical issue. It's a real important one about how this receivership of the Federal Reserve would work and to return gold to the hands of the people.
Yeah, you basically declare the Federal Reserve bankrupt. And what you do is you take the gold and you exchange it for the paper dollars in the money supply so that people have, in essence, gold dollars. And they would represent a very small amount of gold, obviously.
And we don't want to deflate the number of dollars because of all the pain that comes with that, an artificial deflation of the money supply.
That's
so
correct.
Gold would be like, I'll just pull out a number, like $15,000 an ounce. In this, I think DeSoto, Professor DeSoto from Madrid, Spain, did a calculation. And if we updated Murray Rothbard, he did one of these calculations. Maybe it was in the Mystery of Banking. But
that's correct.
At any rate, these are solvable issues.
Well, and Morgan, everybody asks me this question. And at this point is when the economists, the Austrian economists, they've done their work once we get to the point at that point. And then it's lawyers and accountants, in the bankruptcy process who have to take over at that point. They have to undo the strings in the web that have been created for over almost the last 100 years. But basically, we want to take the Fed out of business. We want to get rid of its balance sheet. We want to create a system of gold dollars as well as a system of old-fashioned silver dollars. And there are a lot of functions that the Fed performs that can be and are actually performed in the market economy. But we don't want an elastic currency. We want to make
right.
it non-elastic.
Even the Chicago-style economists recognize that any amount of money is optimal. It's all these fluctuations and create these distortions that are so bad. Morgan Reynolds here on the Dynamic Duo with my guest, economist Mark Thornton. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton of the Ludwig von Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama. And Mark is a marvelous monetary economist, among other talents. And we were on the other side of the break. We started getting into this, well, what should we really do? And we're talking about fundamental reform, not tinkering with an artificial credit expansion machine and a politicized money and banking system. So the first order of business we were discussing was the Federal Reserve ought to be put in bankruptcy and its assets distributed in a way that would give power to the people or back to the people. And I was glad to hear you say, Mark, that economists don't have to do all the heavy-duty technical lifting here, that we can actually have the lawyers and accountants do something productive for a change.
Sure, that's
also,
their job.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
That's their job. I mean, they're the ones that are familiar with the bankruptcy process and its technical details and how those things are worked out, and it's just a matter of applying the legal system as it exists. And that takes care of bankrupt companies and applying the same rules and regulations and same mechanisms to them that they apply to everybody else. And so,
it's inspiring to talk about this. It's not on the near-term political agenda, but imagine all this gold in the hands of the people rather than the government and having a sound money system and how it would nail the monster down. For example, you just can't go invade nations and go on military adventures, start wars willy-nilly. It's very peace-oriented. You'd have the government on a much tighter chain.
Absolutely. That's one of the great things about the gold standard is that it prevents government from doing stupid things like bailout packages and going to war and invading other countries. Those are exactly the types of things that the gold standard helped check in the
right.
past.
Reckless interventions and adventures are just going to be fewer and far further between.
Absolutely. And, they also did the exact wrong thing with with the FDIC. You know, instead of taking away the FDIC insurance, they added to it. They went from $100,000 to $250,000. And, you know, that was the wrong thing to do.
And nobody said boo about the moral hazard there for both the depositors or investors, lenders, as well as the bank operations themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, banks don't need insurance if they have 100% reserves against demand deposits, which is the third component of real reform of money and banking, is that banks have to hold 100% reserves on demand deposits. And, you know, and this is the way it was when I was a kid, so it's not like this is a weird, fundamentally crazy idea. I mean, if you you would go to the bank, you'd make withdrawals, you could write a check, but they would charge you 5 cents every check you wrote, because all they were doing is safeguarding your money. Now, any money you put into a time deposit or a bank bond or anything like that, banks are able to lend that out to make loans on that basis. So, I mean, there's a...
Yeah, and that's a perfectly productive thing. You have a term. You have a penalty for early withdrawal. It's understood that you're lending the money to an intermediary who, in turn, is going to lend it out, and the bank is acting as a middleman, hopefully finds worthy entrepreneurs and business borrowers to put it to productive use, and everything works fine, even though it has a speculative component. But this business about loaning out demand or checkable deposits is, it's just outrageous that they profit by this, and they're just basically spiriting it out in the middle of the night, so to speak, and the legal system is rigged to let them get away with this, and this causes all this trouble of multiplying new loans and building on a narrow base of reserves, et cetera. It gets us in a big, whole lot of trouble.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no need for it as far as the average American is concerned. They want banks, they want the old-fashioned banks. They don't need, you know, these massive financing organizations that Wall Street can take advantage of, and these big banks who get all these fees for, you know, issuing bonds and stocks and all that kind of stuff. You know, the average American doesn't need any of that, even if it did work.
Right, and you know, loans to business or even governments or nonprofits or consumers should be a transfer of voluntary savings. And the trouble with these artificial loans is that they're not backed by voluntary savings. They don't really reflect the time orientation of the consumers, the savers.
No, and as a consequence, you know, America, for most of its history, was just the world's best at building up its capital, saving, investing, building this country, taking nature and making just wonderful things out of it. And now, ever since we went off the gold standard finally in 1971, you know, it's been all downhill in terms of savings, in terms of standard of living, and in terms of redistributing wealth and income from the average American to people at the who are taking advantage of the Federal Reserve and of inflating the money supply and of manipulating interest rates. And that's, you know, Washington and Wall Street. Once again, you know, this tiny minority has the rest of us hostage and is taking advantage of us. It's like they're like a giant parasite on the American populace.
So even free market economists can be disturbed about a maldistribution of income and wealth because it's done through the political mechanism.
Yes, and it's completely, you know, you can't see it. You can't see it coming.
Yes.
The average American doesn't, there's no way to see this unless you understand it at some level, at some theoretical level. And, you know, so it's the perfect ruse to play on the population is to, you know, use this paper money and you know, inflate the money supply and gradually, slowly take away the wealth of the American people.
Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of other things that you mentioned in one of your recent articles about we shouldn't have, or we need to repeal legal tender laws, and we shouldn't have interference like capital gains taxes on gold profits. Explain
right.
those.
Well, you know, right now if we wanted to use gold and silver as money, there's two big disadvantages that we have. One is that there's legal tender laws, which basically the government forces you to use paper currency. You have to pay your taxes in it.
Contracts or might be overridden if I have a contract where we're going to pay in gold. Both parties agree, yet the courts may not enforce it.
That's right. That's right. So you could be at a serious disadvantage because of that legal tender laws, and so that's clearly a big disadvantage. But also, there's the capital gains tax. The government doesn't consider gold money, even though it's in the Constitution. And so if you're buying and selling it, you have to pay capital gains tax on, you know, if the value of it goes up in terms of dollars. And so that's a major
right. And as Ron Paul argues, most of these profits are driven by the depreciation in the paper dollars.
That's right. That's right. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Hey, Mark Thornton, economist, Ludwig von Mises Institute, great interview, such insight. This is Morgan Reynolds, your guest host on the Dynamic Duo. Please rejoin me on Thursday when my special guest will be Dr. Judy Wood, and we'll be discussing 9/11 research. Thank you, and thank you for listening.